You're listening to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host, and I have Andy Steiger.
Good to be with you.
And John Morrison.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so we do annual conferences. So we have one coming up in 2014.
Yeah, March 7th and 8th of 2014, the Apologetics Canada conference. It's going to be good. It's our fourth annual conference.
What's different about this upcoming conference?
There's one huge difference in this year's conference that we haven't previously done, and that is that we're actually seeking to be on at two locations at the same time, which is pretty incredible. And no, boys, we're not trying to break the law of non-contradiction. A lot of people have asked us, they're like, when they hear that we're going to be at two locations, specifically, we're going to be at Northview Community Church and Willingdon Church. They ask me, how are you guys going to do that?
Holograms. That's our answer. We're using holograms.
Well, you know, it's funny because everybody always thinks that Apologetics Canada is a simulcast. Like, for some reason, the idea that we would have these leading thinkers and the number of them present, just it seems like to people it's just inconceivable. But no, it's not a simulcast. Apologetics Canada is not a simulcast, nor are we going to be in two locations in a simulcast. However, we are possibly going to start simulcasting, but that's something we can leave for another podcast. But these will be live. This is going to be live in two locations, and specifically the way we're going to do that is we're going to have our main speakers, we're going to move them from one location to the other. So like on the Friday night, so for example, our main speaker on Friday night, Dr. Clay Jones, would be speaking at Northview on the Friday night. He would be speaking at Willingdon on the Saturday. So in flipping speakers in that way, we're able to move our keynote speakers around. Now, the one thing, though, that the conference will be a little bit different is the breakout sessions will not be identical. Mm-hmm. So breakout sessions at one location would be different than breakout sessions at another location. However, when we put together the Apologetics Canada conference DVD, we will have all of the breakout sessions on that DVD. So that you can, in fact, get the entire conference. Now, the keynote sessions will be the same at both locations. They'll be identical.
Yeah, well, there you have it. We'll keep you informed as things move along. But
yeah, we're shooting to have registration open on October 1st. The website is being updated daily, so people can go check that out. It's www.apologeticscanadaconference.com. Yeah, and we'll be releasing information on that as the conference comes closer.
Just this last conference we had, we were sold out. And so I highly suggest that you do not wait until the last day to purchase your tickets.
Yeah, that's another one of the reasons why we're seeking to do these two venues. One reason is because last year we sold out a week in advance. And there were a lot of people who had plane tickets who hadn't purchased their tickets and stuff. So that made things interesting and we had to open up some extra space. But the other reason is we want to be able to accommodate as many people as possible. And we also are cognizant of the fact that if you live in British Columbia, you'll know that people who live in the city don't like to come to the valley and people who are in the valley don't like to go to the city. So we're seeking to accommodate both of those kind of people.
Let's move along here. You guys are professors or soon to be professors.
To think of it that way, I definitely don't think of myself as a professor. John and I are definitely teaching though this next year.
So where are you guys teaching and what are you guys teaching? John, do you want to start that off?
Sure. I'm teaching a spiritual formation class at Pacific Life Bible College, and I'm really excited about that. It's a place that I've been sending students to, people that are in the mainland or in the valley. I just want a good theological base, but also to be equipped for church ministry. I think this is a really great opportunity for me to kind of get some influence there to train the mind and the heart and how they work together. So spiritual formation really, I think, is an example of of a place where you can learn to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, as Jesus taught us. Not to neglect the mind, but also not to neglect the strength or the heart. And also we're looking at how that affects our relationships as well. So the thinking and the living part is, as I put the syllabus together, I've really grown to appreciate my own journey in this area of how I wish I had someone teaching me about how those things are all interconnected. So I'm excited to do that this fall.
You know, that's kind of interesting. That's one of those things at Apologetics Canada that we do quite a bit that I think that surprises people, is that we're not all about, we're not like this head heavy organization. We're not all about.
We do have large heads.
Yeah, I will. Some larger than others, John.
Yes. I have to custom order my baseball hats if you can't see it, because this is a.
Do you really?
Cranium. Yes, I do. I'm a rather large cranium, which I'm not proud of, but it's just a part of who we are, right?
I'm not really
so
sure.
So we are quite head heavy.
What to say about
being.
That? Yeah. But we want to seek to incorporate the heart. This is about head and heart. It's about both what we know and how we live out what we know. And so it shouldn't surprise people that we would teach a class on spiritual formations, or that we would think that that's is incredibly important. These two things are working in tandem. And it's kind of interesting, although the church as of lately has really neglected the life of the mind, I think it would be a mistake then to pendulum swing all the way to the other end, right, and just be all about the mind and all about the intellect. It's about striking a balance between the two, head and heart. That all said, the class I'm teaching is at Columbia Bible College here in British Columbia in Abbotsford, and I'm teaching a class called Intro to Apologetics. And so we're going to be looking at the whole swath of apologetics, argumentation, and ideas.
And you mentioned before that you think this is a really important step for you guys, for Apologetics Canada, to be involved in these local colleges. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, this is our second year being involved in colleges. I mean, John and I have been speaking out at colleges and universities all over the place. For example, speaking out at BCIT or UFE or wherever. So those are our local universities. But we've also spoken at Trinity Western and Acts Seminary, being involved in even our Bible schools and our seminaries. But we wanted to get more involved in our local Bible colleges. And really, one of the things that we've been seeking to do is first convince our local Bible colleges to teach on the area of apologetics. And it's been an incredible journey to see darn near all of them now, many in Canada, now teaching in the area of apologetics where they once weren't. To do that, though, has meant that we've really had to step up to the plate and help more and even do the teaching ourselves. You know, if that's required, then we want to help in that way. And as well, John and I are really think it's important to invest in our up-and-coming pastors. And I know for you, John, that's one of the main reasons why you are seeking to do teaching.
Yeah, it's exciting to think that you can invest in this age group and that they're going to have a huge influence in the future that they'll be doing. If we can put a seed of why apologetics is important and, speak to some of their lagging doubts that they would have coming out of high school or whatever, and we could speak to that and start to shape their minds, then they'll be the shapers of the future. And so it's just a way to build influence, and exciting opportunities could come of that as well, conversations outside of class and helping them work through some of those. Yeah, I've always wondered this kind of question, because no doubt, they'll be asked that by their youth one day, and they should be always prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks, just as Peter tells us.
Which is interesting, because it means that sometimes we're taken to some unique locations. For example, John, you spent the summer speaking at camps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a great summer. Usually it was something that I appreciate doing. I never was a camper myself, but I see the importance of camp ministry, because at camp you're getting a chance to speak to a often hostile group of kids. People think a Christian summer camp, it's all church kids, but it's not. It's 60% unchurched, never walked into a church. I had one kid tell me that he thought Jesus was a monster that roamed around through the forest at one point. And if you can see, everyone, that this is a radio thing, that Andy and Steve just looked very strange with furrowed brows.
Never heard that one before.
Yeah, that's a first. That was a first.
I've heard everything, like, from, you know, he never existed to he's a Jewish zombie, but a monster that roams through the forest.
That just shows you what we're working with, right? So as I would be walking around after I would talk on one of these topics, these apologetics topics, I would listen to the conversations, and they were everything from, you know, why can I trust the Bible, and did these things really happen? Is Jesus real? Why would God allow this? And why did this happen? Who designed God? All that kind of stuff. These apologetic conversations are happening at all levels, from the camp to the Bible college. And so I've had a great time doing that. And now it's my goal just to take these same answers and develop, or sorry, present them in the different contexts, from coffee shops to classes. So.
You know, on that note, I wouldn't mind just giving Lynette a quick plug. She's a lady who volunteers with Apologetics Canada, and she has a focus on parents, because, like, as John was saying, these questions just naturally come up with young people. These are the questions that they're wrestling with, and so we quickly realized that as an organization, that one of the things that we needed to help if we were going to reach young adults was helping reach their parents, helping equip their parents to have these conversations with their kids, and as they go into adulthood, to parent the life of the child's mind. And so if you go to Apologetics Canada, you can see articles written by Lynette with regard to that. So if you're a parent, I would encourage you to go and to check that out.
Okay, great. So let's then move on to today's apologetics topic, and that is morality. Often when we talk about morality, especially us being Christians and whatnot, a lot of atheists, agnostics, and other skeptics get really offended. We don't need to believe in God. We don't believe in God, but we're moral people.
Yeah, oftentimes they'll hear, like, the moral argument, mm-hmm. that because morality exists, or objective morality exists, then God exists. Right. And then would say, well, if God doesn't exist, well, then objective moral truths don't exist, or morality shouldn't exist then. But then if you talk like that, a lot of atheists, you're right, will get quite offended, because they'll say, well, what are you saying then? You know, that I'm not a good person
because I don't believe in God. I'm not a good person.
That's right. Yeah. That because I don't believe in God, that now suddenly I'm not a good person. We often hear that, where people will misunderstand, say, the moral argument.
So before we go on any further, let's just articulate the moral argument here. It's a syllogism. It says, premise one says, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. And three, therefore, God exists. The trouble is that often skeptics misunderstand the question. They seem to think that what we're saying is that you can't be a moral person if you don't believe in God. That's not what we're saying at all. What we are asking is, well, what is the very foundation of our moral values and duties?
Yeah, exactly. So I would say to somebody, I'd say, listen, I think that atheists are good people, and atheists do good things, right? So whether or not you believe in goodness or can do good things has nothing to do with whether or not you believe in God. But it has everything to do with whether or not God does or does not exist. So what I would say is, if God exists, then morality makes sense. But if God didn't exist, you wouldn't even have, like, a frame of reference for morality. It would be like telling a lion that he was evil for killing a zebra, and a bunny that it was good for eating carrots. I mean, it wouldn't even make any sense. It would be something beyond them, right? And so the whole idea is the very fact that you do have a moral framework, the very fact that you really do believe that some things are truly right and some things are truly wrong, tells you that you do believe in objective moral values, or what is sometimes referred to as a supra-positive, that there is this law above the law that we are all held accountable to. And that being the case, you have to ask yourself the question, where did that law come from? Where did morality come from?
Yeah, the question is, really, are there laws that govern the universe morally like there are laws that govern the universe with physics? So we're asking the question, consider it like, is it like gravity, I guess? You know, every day we're affected by gravity, regardless of whether we know it or not, or think about it or not. Are there laws like gravity with morality? So is there ever a time when it's right for someone to go into a school and shoot little boys and girls? Or is it ever right where Hitler could kill 5 million Jews? Is it ever right, or is it always wrong to do those things? If it's always wrong, no matter what, no matter what his laws say, no matter what he feels that day, is it always wrong for these evil acts to happen? If so, then they are objective moral values and duties.
And often that's where the objection is raised. Well, you know, human societies, you know, they evolved over time, and you know, just to help the species survive, they had to develop this kind of moral code so that people would get along with each other, to help each other, mm-hmm. So that we can flourish.
Yeah, there's what I find when I talk with atheists or people who don't believe that objective moral values, or they believe objective moral values exist, but they don't want to base it in God. So they believe in the morality, but now they have to come out and figure out where did it come from. And there's three main places that I hear them trying to argue for morality. One is that they'll argue that morality comes from people, that people to decide what's good, what's right, and what's wrong. The problem with that, though, is that people disagree with each other. And now you got to figure out who's right and who's wrong. Because ultimately what you want is you want your form of morality to be held to be the objective standard. But then if you try to argue for that, that's going to lead you nowhere. So people have often then defaulted to society. Well, it's what a group of people then decide is what's right and what's wrong, right? And so what society determines is good is now the standard. But the problem there again is what happens when a society takes a standard or a stance of laws. For example, take Hitler, take Nazi Germany, the Nazis. Some people don't know this, but in World War II, Hitler, the Germans, they passed laws so that everything that they did during the Holocaust was in fact legal. They didn't break any of their laws. The problem was, though, is again, societies disagreed with them, right? And said, no, in fact, you did break the law and held them to a law above the law. And we famously know about that from the Nuremberg trials. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden, people don't work, society doesn't work, now where do we go? And often, Steve, with where you're going, I'm hearing this more and more. A principle, right? A principle tends to be now often be argued as the arbiter of what's right and what's wrong. And oftentimes the principle that I hear the most is simply this: whatever adds to human flourishing is good, whatever detracts from human flourishing is bad. And
it's
now very, that becomes a standard of right and wrong.
It's very Sam Harris-esque with his book, The Moral Landscape. That's basically what he argues, right? But then the trouble there is that he's equivocating. He is using the word good and bad in terms of what's useful and what's not useful. What is useful for human flourishing, what's not useful for human flourishing. But that's not good and evil, per se. It's kind of like playing chess, for example. I can make a good move, I can make a bad move. But it's not really the good move in the moral sense or a bad move. It's a bad move in the sense that it's not going to help me win, but it's not an evil move. That's a common sort of objection that people raise, that whatever we can determine what morality is just by looking at what aids the flourishing of sentient beings or human beings or what have you. But again, the problem is you can't find objective morality that way. You're just equivocating again. And we're redefining the word good and evil in terms of utility instead of morality.
And how do you know what's good as well? What's good for us in the next, say, 5 years might not be so good 50 years from now. In fact, it might be disastrous.
Yeah.
And so what appears good might actually be very short-sighted. And unless you have, let's say, a 500-year plan or a 5,000-year plan, or even beyond that, who has that kind of access to that kind of information?
And what says that your good isn't more important than my good that lends to my human flourishing or a certain society's human flourishing? It becomes very complicated to try to tease all that out, what is good and what's not. But here's the crux of the issue. Is who says that human flourishing is good? That, you know, this comes back to Hume's is ought problem. Just because something might be the case, and it may very well be the case that, you know, doing certain activities lends to human flourishing. But there is a big jump to say just because that's the case doesn't mean that that ought to be the case, that I ought to behave in a certain way. Or to put it in a different way, to say that the world ought to be a certain way or ought not to be a certain way. Because now there isn't a way that the world ought to be. Now all of a sudden we're just talking about what's going to be good for a certain society. And I don't know how you would be able to determine that, first off, the very fact that we even know what good and evil is a problem in and of itself. And to me, obviously, that's going back to objective moral values. But the problem is you got this morality, and now how? This is the question that everybody's work, that's like the Sam Harris's, are trying to get at. How do I make it objective? How do I make it binding on all people at all times? Or how do I make it so that everyone is being held under the same morality?
Right.
And I just don't see that you can do that through utility.
I would welcome your comments. This is something that I've been thinking. I don't think it's anything new. I'm pretty sure some philosopher somewhere down the line thought of this. But I was thinking a couple of years ago, and I thought, well, how do you make sense of morality? In order to make sense of morality, you have to be able to explain first moral values, what's good, what's bad. And without value, morality can't even get off the ground. And secondly, you also have to have obligation, duties, right? And so the difference between right and wrong. So how do you explain that? And where is the accountability? So I thought, you know, in order for any sort of moral system to make any sense, you have to have value, you have to have duties, you have to have accountability.
Or another way to put that is justice.
Justice, right. And I just can't... I can't seem to pin it on anything concrete in a non-theistic sort of a worldview. For example, in atheism, I can't see where you're even deriving objective value. I mean, I think we can derive value from things, but I think at best it would be subjective value.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you find objective value? How do we even get value from objective value from a valueless materialistic world?
And you know, on that note, and maybe we should end with this, people, I think the atheists may ask us the same question. You know, well, okay, then theist, well, how are you doing that? How are you making an objective? Because it's often, and John, we were talking about this earlier, how do people often put that? It's what's called the Euthyphro dilemma. And, and ultimately, the Euthyphro dilemma comes from a dialogue that Plato wrote, in which Euthyphro raises this question. And he says,
is something good because God wills it, or does God will something because it is good?
And so this raises a dilemma then for the theist. And it says, in the dilemma, simply this: is there such a thing as good? So it's already objective and exists, doesn't even need God to exist. And so both the atheist or the theist would have access to good. Or is God deciding what the good is, in which case God could call rape good, for example? Mm-hmm. Now, often what happens in a dilemma, or what the philosopher seeks to do when presented a dilemma, is split the horns of the dilemma and demonstrate that there's actually a third option, which is what I would want to propose at this point with the Euthyphro dilemma. And that's simply that the third option is just simply this, that when the Christian talks about morality and objective morality, we're saying that things are good because God is good. God's very essence, an attribute of God, is goodness. Goodness flows from God.
Yeah, and so God's nature is the standard of goodness.
Exactly. So that's what we're saying then, is the objective standard of goodness is God's very nature. And God cannot change his nature. And thus, it's because of his nature that we even know about morality. And that's why the argument follows that if morality exists, objective morality exists, then God exists.
Even if just some moral values or duties exist, it doesn't have to be this comprehensive thing. But even if you have one thing that tells you that something is objectively right or wrong, good or bad, you have to be able to pin it on something.
Right, like torturing children is bad, right?
Even if you have just that, now you have to be able to explain that. Because certain moral codes, so to speak, are culturally driven.
Right.
Culturally derived.
So then the best that you would be able to do is say, oh, I don't prefer to torture children. But that wouldn't be to say that it was wrong. Mm-hmm. See, this is one of the other things that, with regards to Christianity, that I appreciate, is that in the moral framework with God, you not only have a standard for what's right and wrong, but at the end of the day, we will be held accountable to what is right and what is wrong. That the evil that we experience in this world will not go undealt with, will not go unpunished, that people will be held accountable for their actions. This is something that you don't experience outside of a Christian worldview, a theistic worlview, that such a thing is justice.
Okay, well, that wraps up our session today. If you have any comments or questions that you would like us to address, please send an email to info@apologeticscanada.com. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada. Thank you for joining us, and see you next week.